Hello and welcome to this download from Faber and Faber. My name is George Miller, and my guest today is Irish novelist Sebastian Barry, whose latest book, The Secret Scripture, has just been selected for the 2008 Booker Prize shortlist. In the novel, Roseanne McNulty, who is approaching her 100th birthday in an Irish mental hospital, tries to make sense of her past, and in doing so, illuminates a period of her country's past when people could be locked up for not conforming to what society demanded of them. When I met Sebastian, I asked him if it was true that he had based the character of Roseanne on a real person in his own family's history.
Yeah, and I almost hesitate to connect it to her because there's a sort of arrogance in doing so. I mean, I invoke her, and she was the cause of the book, the cause celebre, you might say, that caused the book. But I don't know who she was. I don't know her name. So in my usual way, I've invented a book for her. But one of my great uncles did marry a woman. And then for some reason, he was a rising young politician in Sligo. And for some reason, she was considered unsuitable. And she was tucked away into an asylum in Sligo sometime in the 30s. And forgotten about, so much so that when my great uncle married again and in the course of time died himself, his new family, his children, were shocked, astonished, and possibly even offended to discover their father had been married before and they had never known anything about it, because I think he'd had the marriage annulled, which is one of the stories of the book. And an annulment of marriage doesn't mean a divorce, of course. You're told that your marriage never existed. Roseanne holds on to her name, McNulty, even though she knows that by law, by Vatican efforts, that's part of her life has been erased. So I saw this in 1989. My mother, I was knocking around Sligo with my mother, who was from Sligo, and who would have been a niece of this woman. And she showed me the house, little tin hut in Strand Hill, where they'd put her before they committed her. And she said, that's where that woman lived. And she didn't even have a name for her. And the next time I went down to Sligo, nothing remained of it but the chimney, like in a Wild West story. And then just recently when I went down, nothing remained at all. They had removed the entire place. So as they removed the entire place, I suppose I've been trying to put this in its place. As moral to her, but not as a, you know, to place myself beside her as anything except a member of the family that did this to her.
Her story, in many ways, is not atypical. There were many women like her. Her psychiatrist said at one point in the book she was put in a mental hospital for social rather than medical reasons.
Yeah.
And in the book, it is very striking. There are many institutions. There are mental hospitals. There are convents. There are orphanages. There's a lot of confinement, a lot of people being shut away and their powers of speech or expressing their own stories taken away from them.
Well, it was a form of inner emigration. We know all about the floods of people who had to leave Ireland in all those decades. Even after independence, even a greater flood of people. Because the place was so economically challenged. And I was talking recently to, happens to be a journalist in Galway, and his father, he told me, was the superintendent or the chief psychiatrist in one of the asylums in the West. And he said, you know, it's quite true that this journalist had grown up in one of these institutions as his father's son. He says, you know, it's very true. My father knew that maybe even as much as 80% of the people in the asylum were not people with mental illnesses as such, but people who had been extra surplus people on farms and in families, and there was nothing else they could do with them. Otherwise, the farm would have been divided up so severely that no one could work it, and they might have been the sort of people who would want to emigrate. So one way or another, they were shifted sideways. And I suppose the word asylum then takes on a new meaning. It's a place of safety and refuge, but maybe this was the opposite. I know from my great friend, Ira Brown, who was once the chief psychiatrist of Ireland, rather wonderful title when you think about it. You know, he has told me a lot about the history of asylums and the things that were done to people and the way administrations in asylums would put up with quite a lot before they would dismiss somebody. That would be, say, maybe abusive inmates, because they were little kingdoms unto themselves and they certainly didn't like outside interference. So that was another thing that would, you put your great aunt away, not only into an asylum, but in your mind. But is she safe in that place? And she's surely long dead, but was she safe and what happened to her? That's a sort of retrospective concern. And people just didn't know what was happening to their relatives. And I think it was a comfortable idea that they were being looked after in some way, even though they hadn't the slightest idea what was happening to them. Of course, the recent history of the Magdalen laundries has been revealed in Ireland. In a way, the history of the asylums is inaccessible because the records were so poorly kept. Even in the book, Dr. Green has difficulty accessing her records because the mice have devoured them and all the rest of it. A lot of records were destroyed as well. And it images, in some curious way, what happened during the War of Independence when the forecourts were bombed by the irregular soldiers and all the birth certificates of the nation were destroyed. Oh. And that makes you think of was it O'Higgins saying in the Doyle, because of the Civil War, that we have murdered the baby in its cradle, the baby of Ireland. And you know, and Roseanne has a mysterious child, and that's part of the story as well. And I can see, even as I speak to you, that these things are bound up one with another, which maybe shows you that somehow in going for lost histories, the lost histories of these people, of these lost people, you may then start to be talking more accurately about Irish history, that they embody it in some way. And everything else is just the history of the winners, which is always, to me, a poor story.
The relationship between Roseanne and her father is absolutely central to the book and to her entire life. And I wondered, because it's so poignant in many ways, if you felt as a writer that you had to be both a father and a son to really sort of write yourself into that particular relationship.
I think you have to be as many things as you can be to be a writer. And we're not, unless you have other work, I've done nothing else since 1977, so I'm quite a strange creature. But one of the things, thank God, that I have experienced is being a father. And having had a vexed relationship with my own father, I didn't have much of a template. So for myself, I more or less inventing how to be a father, trying to rewrite the booklet, as it were. The New York Times bestseller list, How to Be a Father, would be a good one. Might be a long and complicated book. So, yeah, I'm hugely interested in that. That's one of my jobs. I mean, my real work is as a sort of taxi driver to my children, because we live remote countryside of Wicklow. I'm always driving them around and trying to meet that obligation, you know, and loving to do it. I suppose not having had a son relationship to my father, the idea of a happy relationship between her and her father is my Martian's view of that relationship, looking at it with amazement and admiration. And I think that's what she has. Although Father Gaunt questions some of the circumstances of the relationship, it's quite evident that that's one of the things that has survived in her, which is just that simple and eternally important love for her father.